We have a very special episode of Levin Jules Break the Rules today. We have our first guest, the Honorable Janati. Janati, I'm the only non-Russian here. How do you pronounce your last name?
Well, if you were to pronounce it in the original Russian, it would be Stolyarov. But for Americans, it's Stolyarov. So I'm Janati Stolyarov II. I'm the chairman of the United States Transhumanist Party.
Among other things, you're a frequent marathon runner. You're an artist, aren't you? You're a composer.
Well, I create works of fractal art. I compose music, largely in classical and other more traditional styles, though through non-traditional instrumentation and arrangements. And furthermore, I'm a writer. So I write articles. I write policy statements for the Transhumanist Party, as well as with regard to my own views. I've written an illustrated children's book, the first of its kind, called Death is Wrong.
I know it is. Book. I have that on my bookshelf. I have a copy of that on my bookshelf.
Yes, indeed. And this book actually was one of the catalysts for my subsequent involvement in transhumanist politics. I've been a supporter of indefinite life extension ever since I was a child, ever since the age of 4 when I first found out about human mortality. And then at the age of 5, I promised that I would dedicate the remainder of my life to the struggle against death and decay through whatever means by which I could achieve the prolongation of life, which in my case involves influencing the general culture, influencing public opinion. And this book, Death is Wrong, was something that had not been done before. It filled a void in the market for available materials on longevity, transhumanism, the progress of science and technology that could help in this area. Because as you might expect, the vast majority of materials in this field are oriented toward adults and adults with quite a high level of education and intellectual sophistication. But for children, there's very little right now to counter the common rationalizations for human mortality that they are faced with pretty much as soon as they find out that humans are mortal. So they're told, oh, this is natural, or this is God's way, or there's an afterlife, or it's selfish to want to live indefinitely, or there will be overpopulation, or people would get bored. And it is so easy to debunk these arguments. And I thought, why not allow children to make informed decisions after being presented with both sides of the issue? So this book, it doesn't seek to indoctrinate kids.
Death is Wrong. The book is called Death is Wrong. And before I want us to go, this is not the first time we're talking about transhumanism, but we have a very eclectic, motley audience. Mm. We have all stripes, all colors, all sorts of different ideological affiliations, spiritualists, scientists, you name it. And I know Lev has become more and more familiar with transhumanism. I wanted to ask Lev, as the non-transhumanist here, as the spiritualist here, what is your understanding of transhumanism so far?
I think that a lot of adults put a border around what is possible and what is impossible. I'd say that for various things related to what people would call the supernatural, but I would equally say it regarding science, regarding what is possible in the realm of human life extension. And I think it's very stupid and almost giving up when a lot of adults say, you know what, I would rather just live out however long God allows me to live out. Because in the series that Jules and I were watching, Castlevania, there was a scene where there was this woman, like, I don't know how familiar you are with the Castlevania lore, but in this scene, there was this woman who went to Dracula, and Dracula gave her all of this scientific knowledge and how to heal various problems that in the, I believe it's the 1400s or 1500s, where the series takes place, a lot of people were dying, you know, in these villages from things that today are easily curable. So she concocts all of these wonderful remedies that today would have been considered to be standard pharmacology. But then the priests walk into her domicile and destroy everything and say that this is the work of Satan, even though she says that this is knowledge that human beings themselves have forgotten about. So I think reclaiming whatever knowledge we happen to, whether we knew about it before or not, I don't think that goes against any idea of, oh, we have to live out a certain amount of time and then that's it. I think the more we give ourselves right now, the more experience people are going to have and the better life is going to be able to be for everybody.
I like the connection you made to Castlevania, because transhumanism has this alien-sounding term. It's not something you hear in common conversation, but it's really nothing that new. It's transhumanism, it's humanism, and trans is for transcendent, right? But how we transcend our human nature, I think sometimes people get weird images of what that means. I think, how would you define transhumanism to someone that you think would be uncomfortable with that idea? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I would say transhumanism is the idea that all of the negative or deleterious limitations of the human condition can be solved and can be overcome to make life better. And in essence, transhumanism has been a current in human thinking for as long as humans have been around, for as long as humans have developed tools, for as long as humans have strived to improve their lives and not just acquiesce to whatever situation they found themselves in terms of their biology or their material resources. So life expectancy, for instance, has increased about fivefold since the Paleolithic era. And a lot of that has been due to some fairly, let's say, basic types of advances, for instance, sanitation or the germ theory of disease or antibiotics or better procedures surrounding childbirth. But nonetheless, now with advanced medical care, more and more diseases are being cured on a case-by-case basis, and people are able to live longer lives, higher quality of lives. Mortality from heart disease has fallen by factors from 3 to 4 compared to the mid-20th century. And all of this is within the spirit of transhumanism. I think you are quite correct, Lev, that there is this common rigidity of thinking where people are comfortable with or accustomed to some aspect of the status quo, and they think, okay, this far, but no further. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's kind of an arbitrary boundary for them to draw, because if they had been alive 150 years ago, they would have drawn the boundary at anesthetics or rail travel. If they had been alive 60 years ago, they would have drawn the boundary at open heart surgery. If they had been alive 40 years ago, they would have drawn the boundary at in vitro fertilization. And yet many people who think this way today, because all of these technologies that I described are commonplace now, would accept those technologies, but they wouldn't accept whatever the next generation of techniques is if they believe their potential to be so transformative as to overcome those rigid boundaries in their minds.
So I love that. We're circling around something I'm aiming at. So are you familiar with Keith Comito from lifespan.io?
Yes, I am quite familiar with him and his work. He does excellent advocacy work and crowdfunding for various smaller scale research projects that are original in their premises and contribute greatly to the advancement of our scientific knowledge in the field of longevity.
Keith, I'm not sure if his thoughts have changed, but we spoke about this years ago. He thought transhumanism was bad PR. He thought that it sounds like you want to become a robot or it's a robot cult or something. And he just wants to emphasize longevity. He's saying, I'm not trying to overcomplicate this. I don't want to die. I don't want you to die. I want radical life extension. But he sort of doesn't include in the conversation, like you said, he creates this boundary where he says, you go this far, but no further. I think he is a transhumanist. I'm not actually sure, but I think when it comes to the PR for lifespan.io, they think that it almost creates an ideological blockage for people when you say, oh, like, well, once you're living 1,000 years or something, and then you have an artificial heart or you have artificial lungs, and now you have a hive mind facilitated by Elon Musk and DARPA. And that's when people start going like, whoa, wait, I thought this was about life extension. And so transhumanism is a school of thought that's trying to think through the beginning of infinity, while indefinite lifespan doesn't quite capture the enormity of transhumanism.
I would say indefinite lifespans are definitely a major part of the transhumanist project. And I would say Keith is a transhumanist, though he might not like to use that term. I will also point out he is the crowdfunding advisor for the U.S. Transhumanist Party, and he is going to contribute a chapter to a book compilation that is edited by Newton Lee, who is our education and media advisor. And hopefully that compilation will be out sometime in early 2019. It will be called Transhumanism in the Image of Humans. And in that chapter, Keith will lay out his own advocacy recommendations, including his views on how the term transhumanism is perceived. And he and I do have some differences there. But I think he recognizes as well that there could be multiple interpretations of the term transhumanism, and it has to do with the prefix trans, which can be read as beyond, or it can be read as through or by means of. So in his view, the undesirable perception of transhumanism is to have that beyond association, that people who are transhumanists would be seeking to become something other than human, but he is favorably disposed toward the through association. So by means of our humanity, by means of what we already do and pursue as human beings, we are hopefully going to actualize these technologies, including the technologies that bring about indefinite lifespans. And through our humanity, we achieve that next stage in our technological evolution. And that is quite a valid perception of transhumanism. It's in accord with the literal meaning. And I would say if he thinks larger segments of the general public are more receptive to that meaning of the term, then it would indeed be desirable to cultivate those associations. But I am very much in favor of the use of the term transhumanism. As Zoltan Istvan, the founder of the U.S. Transhumanist Party and its former chairman, has noticed during his extensive media campaigns and interactions with journalists throughout the world, the term transhumanism is really one that captures the public attention and the public imagination. And sometimes it does engender controversy, but this is the term that really does encapsulate this movement and this attempt to make explicit a tendency within humans that has been implicit and operational throughout our history. And with relation to humanism as well, I would say transhumanism is the logical extension of the humanism that we saw flourish during the Renaissance and the Age of Enlightenment, in the sense that there's the same rational and ethical drive to improve the human condition through systematic means. It's just now we have better tools, and in the future we will have even superior tools for achieving those goals.
So is transhumanism, Lev, does transhumanism sound like a scary word for eugenics or something? Like what? Because I've heard people try to say they're like the same things. I've been hanging out with my friends' families and they crack a joke. Like, isn't that just eugenics? And I'm like, no, not at all. But I'm interested what other people's perception is. Mm.
Well, with whatever isms end up coming about, there's always going to be a group of people that are going to look at the unintended possible consequences that these movements would bring about. When it comes to something like transhumanism, there are a couple of things that stick out in my mind as potential dark areas, one of which is, as you mentioned before, there may be a future, let's say, upper class of people who are able to afford this technology that'll enable the high lifespan and other technological additions. And there would be people on the bottom who wouldn't be able to do it. And at a certain point, these two different classes would go so far apart as to be completely different species in a way. Now, this is all just hyping up the nightmare scenario here, not to say that this is exactly what's going to happen. But out of two things that I'm considering, that's the first one that I'd be interested in seeing Gennady's point of view on.
Yes, certainly. So this kind of scenario, I think, is derivative of the portrayal in H.G. Wells' Time Machine of the dimorphism between the Eloi and the Morlocks, who have diverged in precisely this increasingly rigid stratification. And it was very much premised on the idea of limited mobility between those two groups. However, what we know about technological diffusion suggests the exact opposite scenario occurring. For instance, with the more basic technologies of the industrial age that are ubiquitous today, those actually took a few generations to spread. So from the time electricity was discovered to the time that the majority of homes had electricity in them, it took about 50 years. From the time automobiles were beginning to be manufactured, and largely they were custom made, expensive, clunky, unreliable, to the time that vast segments of the population had automobiles in their possession, it took about 30 to 40 years. Now, on the other hand, devices like these, like the cell phone here, took far less time to proliferate to the majority of the population. We need to recall, for instance, that the first iPhone was released in, I believe, 2007. So that would be 11 years ago. And right now we have people in the poorest countries of the world where cell phones are more ubiquitous than clean drinking water. And that suggests to me that the advanced technologies actually may not be the factors that are generating the kind of inequality that we should be concerned about. And it's not all kinds of inequality that are deleterious. I would say the problematic kinds of inequality are those whereby some people do not have access to the very basic means of survival, like food, shelter, clean drinking water, sanitation facilities, basic medical care. I think obviously we need to be concerned about lack of access to those necessities. But quite often that lack of access is the result of really bad political decisions and sometimes intentional withholding of these necessities from people. But in advanced...
Do you have examples of that?
Let's say Kim Jong-un in North Korea withholding basic resources, especially from those who are of questionable loyalty, or various warlords in conflict zones throughout the world. But Somalia comes to mind, for instance, where, say, in the 1990s, warlords like Mohammed Farah Aidid would withhold food that was sent as international aid to starving Somali citizens, but he would only selectively channel the food to his loyalists. So these kinds of governance issues are largely what is causing severe scarcity. And less, let's say, egregious examples of that do occur in the Western world. Say our current patent system allows certain entities to take medicines that actually had become generic before, but figure out some other application for them. Like instead of treating disease X, they can now be used to treat disease Y and get another patent, which gives them essentially a monopoly on that particular medicine or device for 20 years. And then they can raise the price by several thousand percentage points. We have seen that in several prominent cases, including those involving egregious individuals like Martin Shkreli.
I was just about to mention Martin Shkreli.
Yes. So those types of situations are the kind of inequality that we should be concerned with. But the kind of inequality where everybody gets more of a good thing, but some people get it earlier than others, I would say are not concerning because they're not permanent. And they're not permanent by nature and by design. The first generation of technologies is inherently unreliable. And it has to be custom produced. And when you custom produce something, it's expensive. It involves a lot of labor. It involves a lot of experimentation. With medicine, especially, the first cohort of patients are indeed the wealthier individuals who can afford the experimental treatments. But you can think of them as the guinea pigs, essentially, the test subjects on whom these treatments may actually work less well than in a few generations of the technology. When we have improved knowledge about how it works, we have improved methods of mass production and distribution, and that technology is cheaper, that technology is more widespread. So by the time middle-class individuals or individuals of lower means get access to those treatments, they can be pretty sure of what they're getting, and they don't have to pay nearly as much as the initial wealthier patients. So in some respects, I myself am grateful for those test subjects who take these treatments in prior generations of the treatments as well as prior generations of humans, because I'm fortunately young enough not to have any serious health conditions. And for this reason, I want several older generations before me to receive these treatments first, and essentially have the bugs worked out. By the time it becomes necessary to reverse my own senescence, I want something ultra reliable. I want something ultra affordable. And I do not want to feel like I'm taking any material risk in undergoing such a procedure. Rather, I would only see the benefits, and the costs would have been already borne by that entire system of research and development and experimentation and clinical trials, hopefully several decades before I need to use the results.
That makes sense. So, Lev, when... did you see Black Panther? I'm trying to figure out, when it comes to withholding stuff, was the Black Panther right to think people weren't ready for the technology, or was the Black Panther right, or was the Killmonger right for wanting to like give everybody the tech? I still am trying to wrap my head around this movie. He was just trying to spread the technology, right? But he was just a total jerk.
Unfortunately, I have not seen Black Panther, but I know, I got to see it.
Come on.
But I remember that both Gennady and I came from the former Soviet Union. And back then, you did have this very limited upper class of people in the, I guess you could call it the inner party, to quote George Orwell, who were the ones who were hoarding most of the food, most of the resources, while we could barely find toilet paper. And that is a scary scenario when it comes to the idea people have of a global technocracy that would tell people what to do, when to do it, kind of looking at China right now as an example of a really strong government that can play around with however it is that their people live, like installing that point system where whatever you buy...
their livestock. That's what it seems to me. Like, a lot of the population of China is livestock to the nomenclatura or the crony class, as you will. When we were talking about this, these inequalities, there's two cinematic references, Altered Carbon on Netflix and Elysium, which was the same director as District 9, I believe. So the Altered Carbon, I don't think that's how it would work. But to me, it seemed like an exaggeration of our current economic plight. where you have this ultra elite class, you have a dwindling and almost crushed middle class. The middle class is disappearing. And so you really have this just this dramatic caste system where the opportunities for upward social mobility are essentially an altered carbon, non-existent, right? And they have access to all the tech and other people don't. Even though everyone in this world is kind of operating because it's 2200, they all have their minds backed up. So if you die, your consciousness is tethered elsewhere and they can give you different bodies. Elysium, they're not that far advanced as they are in altered carbon, but they have these regenerative tanning beds is what I would call them. They lie in the tanning bed and it removes all the damage from their cells and they're rejuvenated. And
they get a free tan?
they get the tan, they get the vitamin D, you know, the works. But the Elysium scenario seems more, not tangible, but it seems more relatable or understandable in terms of what a dystopian situation could be. The altered carbon is so far-fetched and so exaggerated that it just seems like a big thought experiment. While the Elysium, it seems in reach in a scary kind of way. Was it Japan or China? They want to start with the space elevator soon? Did you hear that announcement? They want to start working on the space elevator?
Interesting. I wouldn't be surprised if that were a Chinese project. Now, Japan is also quite technologically advanced. I am not sure to what extent there would be as much political will there to undertake a space elevator. But I have some ambivalence toward the current Chinese regime, let's say. I think concepts like the social credit score, which you were describing, are quite frightening. And in my view, unacceptable for a civilized or humane society. But there is a very strong sentiment in Western countries for the value of individuality and individual choice that would prevent that kind of scoring system from arising. Now, there are more localized scoring systems used in various financial applications that have elements of concern. And I have seen some of those systems. I have questioned them, and I have achieved changes to some of those systems to avoid penalizing what would be reasonable and responsible behaviors. However,
could you, just to introduce you more to our audience, because we just jumped into this because we're deep thinkers. You're a benevolent bureaucrat. You work in the monster. You work in the Leviathan over there.
Well, I suppose you could say so, though. I wouldn't consider myself, let's say, to be embedded in the Leviathan. Both I and the agency I work for have considerable autonomy and an ability to take a very objective, dispassionate look at some of these systems and some of these proposals. I would actually say it is very difficult in the contemporary world to say, oh, this is private and this is public, or this is private and this is government, because the more concerning arrangements are ones where business and government are intertwined and the same characters essentially keep going through the revolving door and try to influence policy in directions that are contrary to the interests of most people, but favor the interests of, let's say, a special group, a group that is politically connected, a group that is capable of lobbying, a group that is capable of tweaking the rules, sometimes in a subtle way, for its own financial gain. And the way I see my own role is trying to protect ordinary consumers, people who just want to go about their lives. And when they engage in economic transactions, they want to know what they're getting. They want to know what the terms are, why they are that way, and why some particular treatment is being applied to them. And I think that's a kind of common sense set of desires that would appeal to individual consumers, no matter what their political beliefs, no matter what their views are as to the desirable role of government. Just as they go about their daily lives, they want everything to be transparent and accessible and understandable, and they want to be treated fairly. So what I have seen in a lot of systems is that many of the mistakes or damaging consequences arise not from some conspiracy, not from some nefarious intentions, but from bad design and failure to anticipate the unintended consequences. I've spoken to actuarial audiences about this, about the danger of just treating a complex statistical model or a predictive algorithm as a metaphorical black box. And you put data in, it spits out an indication, and you rely on that indication because it's ostensibly more objective than somebody's opinion. However, the manner in which you design the model, the kinds of inputs you use, the kinds of assumptions you use can affect the outcome. And I think with more awareness of what kinds of impacts are possible, as well as what you're trying to do with the model, what you're trying to measure, what outcomes you're trying to achieve, a lot of these treatments of concern can be prevented or corrected. Now, with China, which was the original, let's say, subject that brought about the reference to these kinds of models, the issue is there is a social control aspect that is deliberately built in to a model like the social credit score. It's not just that somebody wants to sell you something or somebody wants to pick out the most profitable clientele. Those, in many respects, are more innocuous motives. Generally speaking, I would say true capitalists have more limited and innocuous motives than people who seek to engineer a particular vision of what society should be like through these kinds of tools. So the social credit score is intended to measure how good of a citizen you are in the context of being a good worker, being obedient to the Communist Party, consuming the right kinds of media, having the right kinds of friends, not committing crimes, but also not thinking too freely for yourself. So in some cases, it may penalize some genuinely bad and antisocial people. But what we rightly are concerned about is that the social credit score penalizes people who are just different and may even be different in very salutary ways, but they run afoul of the current agenda of the regime. So that's the problem with the Chinese system right now. I'll speak to some of the positive.
That's almost sounds like putting it lightly. I just try to remind everyone they have execution vans over there. Like anyone that ever watched Judge Dredd, Sylvester Stallone, or the remake, they've got execution vans in China that if your name goes on a list, it's like you got taxi cabs, you got ambulances, you got police cars, you got execution vans. And they're judge, jury, and executioner in there. And they'll just pick you up in the van and they'll strap you to the board and they'll just end you right there. They picked up a billionaire. There was a billionaire in China who found himself on the execution van list right through the bureaucracy. And they just picked him up after work and they executed him in the van. Like if that doesn't terrify people, like when you're talking about the social credit score and everything else, I just try to emphasize they have execution vans, and it's a nightmare.
I would need to see some sources for that. Of course, it's not exactly a transparent society, but that seems more.
Wikipedia. No, this is common knowledge. You could just look at Wikipedia right now. Type in execution van.
Let's see.
And while you're looking at that, I wonder how many people over here in the United States, like in Silicon Valley, maybe salivating over the amount of control that China is able to exert on the citizens. Not everybody in Silicon Valley, mind you, but I still have a feeling that when there are people out there who climb the ladder who think that maybe it would be a good idea to censor things like right now that's happening with Gab.ai that got shut down and, you know, name whoever you want to name here as far as people who have been shut down by big tech, in alliance with government as well. It's not a purely capitalistic system here. So I don't want the trend over here in the land of the free, home of the brave, to go the road to not just the EU as far as censorship, but something like China as far as censorship. We're still very far away, but the idea that these things are being looked at as, that may not be such a bad idea, that's a little bit scary to me.
Right, right. And I see very concerning trends in censorship on social media sites right now, in particular Facebook and Twitter, banning or delisting certain accounts solely based on their content and not even based on the form of the expression. So I can understand banning someone for harassing someone or doxing someone or just using nothing but completely hateful language if a site has a policy against that and it's a private site. But for holding a different point of view or for not being a mainstream media outlet, as we've seen with a lot of the bans recently, that I would say crosses the line into egregious behavior. But I do see, by the way, the execution van entry on Wikipedia. It does seem to have started in 1997. And the Wikipedia entry says, the van allows death sentences to be carried out without moving the prisoner to an execution ground. The vans also require less manpower per execution, requiring four persons to assist with the lethal injection and are mobile. The People's Republic of China states that the vans are more humane than previous forms of execution. Human rights groups predict that the execution rate in China will increase because of mobile capital punishment. Now, here's a question that I have, and I don't know the answer. Do they only use the execution vans if a sentence has been handed down by a court and there's an official process by which a person is still sentenced and can appeal, and after the appeals are exhausted, that's when the execution is carried out? So is it just a different method after a similar legal process, probably not as strong as in the United States, or is it somebody just gives the order and the person gets disappeared and executed, which is more of what the Stalinist, Maoist, Pol Pot regimes have done?
They might go through some kind of informal ritual or ceremony to sort of save face amongst the insiders making those decisions. It's like Justin Trudeau said, he admires China's basic dictatorship because of their ability to enact certain things much faster than resistant bureaucracies with minds of their own. So that's what the totalitarianism and authoritarianism of China can accomplish. I think it does come down to if their president said, I want this guy on the list, I think that's the process. I'm not sure if there's anything else. I don't know. I wouldn't want to be a lawyer in China, though. I can tell you that. I wouldn't want to be on the wrong side of that.
Oh, yes. They have, I would say, a much more limited set of due process rights than people in the West in terms of, first of all, the natures of the offenses that could be considered criminal.
You are almost frighteningly dispassionate about just, it's such a reasonable question. Like, well, what is the due process? But I was just like, because I really try to sensationalize the excommunication bans because I think they need, like, I think that kind of, people need that jolt. I think they need that wake up call to, you know, hello, like, I don't care what your due process is. The execution bans are not what we want over here.
Well, we do have the death penalty in many jurisdictions in the United States still, and it's very expensive, and it's very
time-consuming. It's artificially expensive, and that's because of, I mean, we can get into the how our whole system is baked in, but people who are anti-death penalty have put in all these regulations and fees you have to pay and motions you have to file and the whole process of who you need to have present at the execution and the table and all the checks and you need to make on the equipment and the actual serum they're using, the poison to kill you. It's artificially expensive. Like if you just, it's not expensive to kill someone. I hate to break it to you. Anybody that wants to tell you that capital punishment is more expensive than having a prisoner in prison for life for 60 years has been brainwashed, right? Because they're telling you a fact, but they're not telling you why it is a fact. Yes, it's more expensive to execute someone in the United States than to have them be a prisoner for their entire life, but that's not because it's more expensive to kill someone, right? It's really cheap to kill someone, right? Like if you had to feed someone three times a day, every day for 60 years, that's more expensive than shiving them or tying a rope around their neck and throwing them off a bridge, right? But that's not how executions happen here. So they're artificially expensive, which is a great, I'm sorry to drag on, but it's a great metaphor though for how so many things here are artificially expensive. Like when people think about these therapies being so expensive right now, like there are groups of people who want to focus on how do we bring prices down in the market? Like, how could we accelerate progress by stripping away these artificial hurdles that are driving prices up? And when you look at something like the death penalty in America being more expensive than a lifetime prisoner, it's a sick metaphor for how things are artificially expensive and how if government and politicians focus more on crushing prices, we could accelerate things in an opposite way that an authoritarian like Mao Zedong or the current president of China does, right? Because they want that authoritarianism to speed processes up. But there are other bottom-up ways of speeding processes up that don't depend on top-down centralization and authoritarianism.
Oh, I would agree. There are many changes to policies, many removals of barriers that are possible to bring down costs in medicine, as well as in many other areas of technology. And I was going to say, in the Chinese system, because a lot of the Chinese regime seems to be comprised of technocrats of a sort, they consider a certain kind of technological progress to be desirable so they can, in a sense, lower the costs from the top down. That's not necessarily the best approach. It doesn't take into account actual supply and demand considerations and the preferences of their subjects. But it does enable them, for instance, to construct large infrastructure projects more effectively than can be done under the American system, where you have tens of different special interest groups who each want to intercede in the process and include some sort of requirement or protest it or oppose it or make sure that a rail line goes through their district or doesn't go through their district. And that in a large way has held back the progress of infrastructure in the United States, whereas in China, they can put up a high-speed train line within a few years and even construct an entire new city within a few years. Of course, their problem is getting people to live there, given that they haven't taken into account the actual economic considerations that would lead people to choose to move to a city or not. But in terms of, say, executions, in the United States, there is a very common extrajudicial form of execution. It arises in the form of the mentality that is inculcated in a lot of police officers to shoot first and ask questions later. And the rate of police killings in the United States exceeds that of any other Western country. And all the police officer has to do is say, oh, I felt afraid for my life. And that's it. And they can kill a person after doing that. And I think some of them think, oh, I'm dealing with an obvious criminal or an obvious person whom I'm critical or whom I disapprove. And I know that if I were to take this person into the court system, it would take years for anything to get done. So some police officers will just pull the trigger for that reason, I suspect. But I think in most cases, the problem is with their training. The problem is with this mentality that every encounter is potentially lethal. And therefore, whenever a police officer interacts with a person, they're taught to think of all the ways they could kill that person. That to me is more concerning than a legal sentence of death that is handed down, because there is absolutely no due process in that. And the only protection, which only works some of the time, is to be extremely deferential to the police officer and be ready to cooperate in every single respect. But that also works with, let's say, differential success rates for different people. If you are approaching a police officer dressed the way I am, probably you're going to come out of that encounter alive. But let's say you're in the inner city and you're
wearing my hoodie.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Yeah.
It's a very difficult
question. I've got a bulky wallet here. It's a dark alley. I'm flipping it around. Yeah.
I mean, we can't pretend, though, that there are instances of police getting shot or stabbed or whatever means of violence happening against them in these troubled areas. And I personally think that once the war on drugs will be more or less over, a lot of that kind of violence should go the wayside, because that, I think, has been the prominent reason why a lot of these unfortunate happenings have been going on.
See, I love due process because it protects us from authority or abuses of authority or abuses of power. But I think when it comes to these systemic problems, people talk about systemic racism with police officers or with our institutions, the public school system, we lack a lot of the local solutions that could remedy this, because I think a lot of people have their hands tied behind their back or they're paid to sit on their hands. I've heard there was someone went to TMZ recently and was talking about, I haven't followed up on the sources with this, but this is what he was saying, that the CIA or the FBI was paying the churches, the local churches, to not get involved in community disputes. So in the past, it was these spiritual leaders, people that genuinely lived by charity. I'm not talking about Joel Osteen. I'm not talking about Ron L. Hubbard. I'm talking about people that lived in their communities, cared about their neighbors, and if they saw a troubled adolescent or a broken home, these are the types of church leaders or community leaders that really cared about the social fabric of their communities. And over time, the CIA and the FBI started paying the church to just not get involved, just sit it out, just keep doing your Sunday service, keep doing your Wednesday service, you know, don't stop doing your job, but we want you to not be as involved. And if that's true, I would be very curious as to not why they did that, just the unintended consequences of it.
Right.
I'm not trying to be a psychologist and get it, like try to figure out everybody's intentions, because I think a lot of people have great intentions, and it doesn't matter. I think what really matters are the effects of your actions. And I think if we think about, okay, we have these local problems in Detroit or local problems in Chicago, and the politicians haven't been able to fix it for a very long time. So how could genuinely passionate, whether they're entrepreneurial or spiritual people, heroes, community leaders, you name it, how can we solve some of these local problems so that there's so much less tension, not just between cops and citizens, but amongst neighbors? And because I think a lot of people, when they think about the current economic system, I think what's happening is people are getting crushed between raising taxes and inflation. And that's why we have this diminishing middle class. But I think a lot of people, they look at this needless immiseration that our quote unquote capitalism is contributing to. I would say it's not capitalism, it's crony capitalism. It's the right. regulatory exploits that our government allows cronies to exert, like with their capitalistic agenda. They're able to levy the government to be an active player on their behalf. I lost my train of thought and I was right there.
There is an incestuous relationship between the government and all these special interests. So right. One of the things that I'm curious about when it comes to the Transhumanist Party is how much power do you want the private interest to have and how weak do you want the government to be? Because from what I understand, you wrote personally for the Mises Institute. And I know that those guys, they're very much against any kind of strong government. I'd say around minarchist to full-on ANCAPs. But I'm curious about your own stances on this. Where would you say the balance is?
Just to punctuate, people think that the reason why some cars are slow because of fast cars. That's all I wanted to say. That people have this envy problem or they have this problem with the equality divide because they think that people with more money are making it harder for people with less money to have more. Yeah. But it's not that fast cars make some cars slow. It's that the way we've regulated the lanes is slowing down everybody's car. That was it.
Yes, certainly. And I would say within the Transhumanist Party, among our members, there is a variety of perspectives about the appropriate role of government and the extent to which government should be the mechanism to achieve these technological advancements and improvements in people's quality of life. However, in terms of my own view, I would say the most important function of government is to serve as a kind of objective referee and guarantor of individuals' rights, but without seeking specific outcomes or conclusions, rather setting up the system in such a way that people, through their own activities, which could be in the form of business, but could be entirely non-monetary or volunteer-based, would reach good outcomes. And in that sense, my own view is people, when they try to solve their own problems and coordinate with one another to solve them, tend to do a better job than when a centrally planned solution is imposed upon them. Because the centrally planned solution necessarily lacks nuance, and it lacks an understanding and recognition of the particulars of a given situation and what it is really that brought a given problem about. So in terms of, for instance, community organizations in inner cities not being prohibited, but being discouraged from interceding in disputes, that is undesirable because these kinds of local informal solutions do tend to work better than a top-down imposition. They're more cognizant of what Hayek referred to as the circumstances of time and place. Now, that being said, as I mentioned previously, it's very difficult now to disentangle what really is a private interest versus what is government action. And furthermore, because the two have been so closely intertwined for so long, indeed for much of human history, it is very difficult to say, if that weren't the case, what would the economy be like? What outcomes would exist? What technologies would be available? I think it's more realistic to look at an incremental path and to see, given the status quo, what policies, measures, changes, either from the standpoint of what the government does or changes in the wider society, can bring us to a more desirable situation. And that would be looked at in terms of outcomes. So improved quality of life, greater lifespans, cures to particular diseases, improvements in infrastructure, or, say, improvements in prosperity for large segments of the population. There is a problem with the middle class being imperiled in the United States. I think there's a patchwork of bad policies that are contributing to that. And I think also a part of the problem is cultural, in the sense that there has been, for instance, this erosion of the concept of employers being loyal to their workers, which was pretty ubiquitous in the United States between about 1910 and 1980. Even in the 1970s, layoffs were extremely uncommon. mostly if people were terminated from their jobs, they were terminated for cause because they as individuals had done something in violation of the company's policies. And generally it had to be something fairly egregious. Now one could claim these types of more favorable treatments were not extended to the entire population. People in various minority groups, women, recent immigrants generally didn't benefit from that kind of favorable treatment. But the structures for the favorable treatment were there and they could have readily been expanded to greater segments of the population. But there was a large cultural shift, especially around the early 1980s, whereby employer loyalty was discarded in favor of essentially short-term profit maximization. This is a particular problem for publicly traded companies. It's less of a problem for closely held private companies. But the publicly traded companies that are regulated extensively by the Securities and Exchange Commission, that have been litigated against considerably by various activist shareholders who believe that their quote, right to maximize the stock price is more important than the fundamentals of the company's operations. Those are the changes that led a lot of these large publicly traded companies to say, okay, we're going to squeeze our workers. We're going to try to maximize the bottom line, maximize quarterly earnings, inflate the share price in the short term, sometimes by selling off our assets and then leasing them back because that looks better from a cost-based accounting perspective. And in the long term, that creates a lot of instability within the corporations. It means they always operate on the margin of failure. Just like, say, a just-in-time inventory system means if there is some sort of disruption in the logistical chain, all of a sudden you don't have supplies, you don't have inputs to manufacture your product, or you don't have goods available to consumers. So intentionally, from about the 1980s onward, private companies, with various regulatory pressures and pressures from litigation, have deprived themselves of the considerable redundancy that had been built into the system over the preceding generations. And now there is very little job security in the private sector. And employees themselves have switched to a different mindset, which is, if my employer won't be loyal to me, why should I be loyal to my employer? So there's more of a mercenary mindset, a job-hopping mindset, so to speak. And the entire society has adopted this mentality that everything is in ceaseless flux and we must be ready to change every aspect of our lives at any moment because we don't have anything firm to rely on anymore. That's not necessarily, and I think it's almost certainly not how a truly free market would operate, because that kind of constant flux is contrary to some very core human motivations. One of those motivations is, if you work hard, you expect to actually achieve something and make your subsequent life easier than it was before. And I think in many cases, even people who do succeed financially, who are good at their jobs, who could be considered middle class from a pure income or wealth standpoint, still have a reduced quality of life because they have to fear for what is going to happen to all of that income tomorrow. Or if they've taken on a vast amount of debt, which, by the way, was highly stigmatized even two generations ago, but is now fairly routine in American life.
It's like Keynesian economics has influenced everybody's view on debt.
Yes. Yes. And it used to be that the biggest deficit spenders were governments, and largely private citizens still had some modicum of financial restraint or a desire to have balanced budgets for the household or for a private business. But this mentality that, oh, debt is just something that everybody takes on, whether it be in the form of student loans or car loans, which were, by the way, considered rather, let's say, a certain type of financial irresponsibility, even when I was a child. So I was told, for instance, when I was a student in middle school and high school, that, well, a lot of people don't need car loans, but some people take them out because they want to drive a higher quality vehicle or a nicer looking vehicle than they can afford out of their own resources. But it was kind of seen as a frivolous indulgence and not a lifestyle that large segments of the population relied on, which it seems to have become now.
Is this debt also built into our monetary system when it comes to the Federal Reserve notes?
I would say to a large extent, yes. So the Federal Reserve lends out money to banks, and it lends it out at a very low interest rate, but essentially the Federal Reserve creates entries on the bank's balance sheets. It's not even the physical notes get exchanged anymore. But the banks who are recipients of that money then have a certain amount of discretion as to what to do with it. So they can choose to sit on it. They can choose to lend it out. And in the majority of instances in prior history, most of the time the banks would just lend it out. And there would be the famous Keynesian multiplier effect, because of fractional reserve banking, to lend out a certain amount of money. Banks only have to have a fairly small fraction of that amount sitting in terms of actually in their possession, whether physically or electronically. But then at that point in time, that money enters general circulation and people can use it to purchase goods or they can use it to make other loans. So this is fractional reserve banking. And some of that isn't dependent on Federal Reserve policy. The Federal Reserve tries to influence it by either lending out more or lending out less. But a lot of it is also dependent on private institutions' decisions, which is actually one reason why a lot of Keynesians hate people who save money, because people who save money are taking that cash out of that general circulation, so it doesn't have that multiplier effect. It's not being lent out to anyone else. However, people who are saving money are also being financially responsible, and they are essentially making a provision for the future by setting aside some of what is supposed to be a measure of value, however imperfect, and saying, we're not going to consume that now. We're going to wait to consume it until we need it or until some sort of unforeseen circumstance arises. And the Keynesians dislike that because now that amount doesn't get lent out. So there is a big cultural problem also, that economic prosperity is conflated with spending. Spending is not what brings about prosperity. Spending is the act of consumption of the wealth that is available. What brings about prosperity is creation or production. And technology can facilitate that. Technology generates the tools that are needed to produce new goods and services that people enjoy. But I would say for the end consumer, whether you buy more food or less food, whether you buy a more luxurious set of home furnishings or a less luxurious set of home furnishings, that's all in the realm of personal choice. And I'm not seeking to disparage any particular kind of choice as long as people can afford it. But the notion of affording it has become dramatically different over the past three decades as compared to what it used to be. So it used to be you had to have the physical money in your possession to afford something. And then you had to think about, if you are deprived of that, how will the rest of your life be? And will you be able to provide for necessities? And now the idea is, oh, can you afford the minimum payment on your credit card? Which is entirely contrary to prudent long-term planning. So I think even if all of these deleterious controls on people's economic decisions were repealed tomorrow, we would still have a huge cultural problem on our hands. And it may take a generation of education in order to get people to recognize what it means to be financially responsible again.
When it comes to doing that, I imagine one instinct would be a top-down approach. But the only problem is that the people who are on the top are the same people, the government, who have this incestuous relationship going on with all of these special interests, with all these private multinational corporations. So why would they ever do anything? And then I am left at an impasse where I'm not really sure what the best way forward is. I imagine something like cryptocurrency could be a big help in changing the system in a very significant way. What do you think?
Yes, I think cryptocurrency as a concept is quite promising. I think it would have that effect if it were to enter general circulation as a medium of exchange and a fairly stable store of value, rather than its current role as a primarily speculative instrument or an instrument for fundraising for certain business ventures, as would be in the case of an initial coin offering. But the original promise of cryptocurrencies would be, and was, as articulated in Satoshi Nakamoto's 2008 paper introducing Bitcoin, is to have a system of exchange which doesn't require an intermediary to validate transactions. So it doesn't require a clearinghouse the way that banks have historically served as clearinghouses. And if you don't have an intermediary, if you have a system that is transparent to everybody and everybody owns a copy of the same ledger, then you can have a truly decentralized system that is freer from manipulation. You just have a system that functions according to its initial rules. Now, there are many types of rules that are possible. Some cryptocurrencies are more deflationary, like Bitcoin. Others are more inflationary. Others are designed to be as stable as possible or to even track fiat currencies. And then there are technologies of the blockchain, like smart contracts, for instance, that seek to go beyond even the concept of a currency or a medium of exchange and actually have transactions themselves be self-executing according to certain rules. So that's the next generation after just cryptocurrencies. And the particular infrastructure of these kinds of arrangements is going to evolve. So I don't know, for instance, if Bitcoin is going to be the surviving cryptocurrency in such a world. It was the first, and it has a first mover advantage. But in terms of facilitating large numbers of transactions, its infrastructure is rather poor at doing that. But some successor blockchain-based technology could incorporate a cryptocurrency, a platform for self-executing smart contracts, and various other features as well. This is what Ethereum has endeavored to do, for instance, to the point where some people were designing completely frivolous types of, I wouldn't even call them contracts, devices on the Ethereum blockchain, the so-called CryptoKitties, which were essentially computer game animals that existed on the blockchain and could be bought and sold. And at the height of the crypto bubble, they were sold for hundreds and even thousands of dollars sometimes. And that was, of course, a very strange time, and an illustration that you could have speculative frenzies that are completely independent of government policy. But for whatever reason, the speculative aspect of cryptocurrencies antedated the widespread introduction of cryptocurrencies as media of exchange, which we are yet waiting to see. But I think the sooner we have cryptocurrencies in general circulation that compete with fiat currencies, the more likely the outcomes that you were describing, Lev, would be to come to pass.
And what would be, if you had a crystal ball in front of you, what would be certain predictions that you could make regarding the next, let's say, decade or so? Like, what do you expect to see happening culturally and as far as the amount of jobs people will have or the way that people will live in general? Do you think there's going to be a broad change?
So I think there will be several major changes. In terms of jobs, I think the changes will be more incremental than most people fear or suspect, in the sense that there has already been widespread automation, and automation will continue. For instance, in the realm of vehicular autonomy, I think we can expect to see large numbers of autonomous vehicles on the roads within the next 10 years. But that doesn't mean there will be massive waves of unemployment. We could conceive at some point of a sufficiently advanced technological society where nobody needs to have paid employment, where all of the jobs are done by automata, and people just have universal basic incomes that are, in essence, a dividend from what those machines produce. But we will not be there in 10 years. The jobs that are going to be automated are jobs that are repetitive, high throughput, generally simpler in nature, but they could be physically riskier or physically more destructive to individuals. So you could have, say, an assembly line worker who doesn't really get exposed to that much physical danger, but he has to bend in a particular way for 8 hours a day. And doing that for many years in a row is going to give him back problems or other kinds of health problems. So those jobs, if they're automated away, can actually result in more opportunities for those individuals, especially if employers adopt a more humane mindset that if a particular job function is now obsolete, that's not a justification for discarding the person. It's a justification for retraining the person and perhaps giving that person a more intellectually challenging, varied, safer, and higher paying job. A job that uses a person's creative faculties to a greater extent. So I am a strong advocate of employee education and of internal company cultures that facilitate investments in their own workers. And that, I think, if implemented, could result in a lot of the resistance to automation fading away. Because if a person, let's say, is a truck driver right now, and a lot of trucking jobs are dangerous, there are numerous accidents, and I think we've all been witnesses to some of those accidents, where you have a semi topple over and it's blocking multiple lanes of a freeway, or even all of the lanes of the freeway. And sometimes the drivers are overworked. They have been operating for, say, 16 hours a day, though various federal restrictions have tried to clamp down on that. And a lot of them are not particularly well-trained, even though they are fairly well paid because of a shortage of supply for truck drivers. It's not a very pleasant job. So if instead they are told, okay, we don't need you to drive the vehicle. For a while, we'll let you sit in the cabin as a safety monitor, essentially. And you're going to track key statistics of the vehicle's operation. You're going to report back to us. We're going to give you some mechanical training, some training in the software that powers the autonomous vehicle. We don't want the truck stranded on the road. So if there are bugs in the program, you are going to be able to fix them. And for a lot of the existing workers, that could be an enticement, essentially. You get an easier job, you don't get a pay cut, but this vehicular automation will improve safety. It will reduce the potential for people to litigate against the trucking company because there would be fewer accidents, so fewer causes for litigation. Ultimately, it will save the business money anyway, but then you won't have this constituency of people who fear being displaced by automation. And I would say with virtually every job whose functions can be automated, you can train a human to do something different. And it's a question of, is the same company going to do it, or are those people going to find opportunities with different companies, or are they going to become self-employed? That's an open question. And for different individuals, different solutions may be optimal. But I think we are going to have this kind of incremental automation of jobs that are higher throughput. Not in all cases physical jobs as well. You could have, say, a craftsman who creates very unique ornaments, or, say, tables with ornate carvings. And that person's job is probably less likely to be automated away, especially if he imbues each creation with some distinguishing features of his individuality. But somebody who, for instance, processes large volumes of data in the same way, except previously that processing was done manually, that could be automated. On the other hand, somebody who uses the outputs of an algorithm that processes large volumes of data and has to make a decision regarding what to do with that information. That is a very cognitively intensive, high-level type of judgment that current narrow AI systems cannot perform. So any type of job that pulls in information from a wide variety of domains that requires reference to other spheres of life, to other developments in the economy and technology and politics and current events, and requires forming some general principle from that information that could then be applied in a variety of contexts, that is very much still going to have to be done by a human. And that's a lot of highly paid professional work today. So I'm actually skeptical of those who say that a lot of highly paid professional positions are going to be automated away. They'll certainly change and they'll certainly evolve, but I don't see professional judgment being replaced anytime soon. As a good example, doctors, for instance, will have medical AI assistants and diagnostic software, of which, say, IBM's Watson is a common prototype. And yet, you're still going to have individual patients who are going to want to approach doctors with a particular condition. And a doctor can collect the symptoms or collect various scans and feed them into the diagnostic AI. And the diagnostic AI might analyze huge volumes of medical literature, more than the doctor could have possibly read through or studied in medical school or studied in the course of continuing education. And then the AI would say, okay, here are some probabilities of what it could be. And here's some relevant literature, and the doctor could use that. But the doctor still has to say, okay, how likely is this to actually be the case in practice? Or let's explore this possibility, but there are some other reasons to be skeptical. Or there are some data inputs that the AI might not have been properly configured to consider. So in that case, you still need a human. And I would say the jobs of the next decade, and probably the next 3 decades, are going to be along the lines of this human-machine collaboration, where you have increasing use of domain-specific algorithms unified by intelligent professional judgment. That's at least the desirable evolution in the sense of what would a prudent business do? What would people in a society generally characterized by prudence try to do? There are some short-sighted individuals. If we have a lot of Martin Shkreli's in our economy, then there would be more displacement than that. But having intelligent discussions around these technologies can hopefully help us avoid that.
So when I'm thinking about the next 10 years, I'm very interested in some systemic movements. And I think things that we should expect, there's going to be this increased tug of war between decentralization and centralization. I think that when you look at the libertarian appreciation of cryptocurrency and the Chinese or authoritarian embrace of AI as a tool to help a small number of people control a much larger number of people. I think that not just thinking about jobs or how culture might change, I think that that tug of war is going to become more crystallized, how existing power structures and the powers that be are going to do what they can to maintain those dynamics while technology is disrupting and potentially revolutionizing or transforming a lot of pre-existing power structures. Something that I think we really need to see in the next 10 years, and this might be a great pivot point, we could call it a spectral revolution. And this is something Giorgiani talks about. I have not finished his book, Prometheus and Atlas, but I think that it's relevant to other things. So I'm using some of his vocabulary to talk about subjects, but I'm not directly talking about Giorgiani's ideas. And when we look through history, what were the catalysts to cultural revolutions? The Enlightenment, the Renaissance, when the Gutenberg press was invented, when Martin Luther, you know, nailed his paper on the church doors. I think that culture needs to solve, at least here, the mental health epidemic. And I think this is a modern contemporary dilemma. You can call it an existential crisis, a crisis of philosophy, or a crisis of understanding of modern neuroscience. But when we see the trend of pharmaceuticals to treat mental illness and psychotherapeutic drugs, school shootings, things like that, I think that there is a mental health and philosophical revolution we need. And I think that culture is really the battleground for that. I don't think the formality of politics can help create a thriving culture that gives people that kind of, you could call it a self-assurance or tranquility or spiritual health or self-determination, all these things that I think have been stunted in people. That I think a lot of people, Giorgiani says, he thinks people have been suppressed, that they're being deprived of information or enlightening ideas that could really transform our cultural fabric. And I think these are very interesting ideas that I've only just started to tip my toes into. I'm reading his book, Prometheus and Atlas, which is very, very interesting. It's opening up my mind in ways that I haven't experienced in a couple of years. You know, every now and then you read a book and it's, and you're like, it's revealing a piece of the picture that you didn't even know you had a blind spot on. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is one of the big challenges of the next 10 years is we need a cultural response or a cultural revolution, just like we had in the Enlightenment or the Renaissance, or when Martin Luther nailed his paper on the church door, when the Gutenberg press was invented and spread the written word everywhere. I think now with the internet and the hyperconnectivity of our world, we need this spectral revolution, which is, as Giorgiani uses very interesting language, one of the things he talks about is hauntology, that people need a hauntology. And there's this, the way he speaks sometimes, it's hard to know how, because he combines religious and technological concepts together, where people used to think in terms of God was always watching them, but now he talks about animal intuition and how all of each other, we watch each other. And if you even think about our systems, how we have these cameras and microphones that can be used to look at us and also used to look at other people. That if you're aware of your presence in relation to everyone else, that these things could contribute to improved mental health awareness, improved, I don't know. I know this is a problem. I know that the mental health thing is a problem. And how do you solve mental health? I don't think that mainstream psychologists do a very good job. I think part of it is that they depend on recurring customers. You know, if you cured everyone that came through your door as a psychologist, you'd put yourself out of business. You need them to keep coming back and getting a prescription or speaking to you on their armchair. And I think that it's hard to teach people self-reliance, or it's hard to empower the sovereign individual when people's own mental machinery seems to be eating itself within. So I think that we need to raise the psychic intuitions of people. We need to elevate people's awareness, and maybe that is a spreading of our knowledge of modern psychology, and we need that to impact the culture in a big way, or we need information that is suppressed to be revealed so that people can empower themselves.
Yes, and this is an important subject, especially because I would say contemporary culture offers very few solutions. In more traditional cultures, the solution was just say no. And I'll use the analogy to a game series that I played a few years ago, the Dragon Age series. So in the Dragon Age series, there is this force of blood magic, and blood magic can be very tempting to use for individuals who are frustrated by the world in some sense, because it gives them this impression of power or the ability to overcome some range of the moment problem. But inevitably, blood magic will always rebound against them and harm them in some gruesome and catastrophic way and harm others as well. So the common damaging behaviors that we see today, whether they be suicide or drug abuse or mass shootings, I would say they are kind of the blood magic of our world. And it's always bad. And in traditional societies, people were more forthright in saying, this is always bad. You should never do it. Just don't. Whereas in contemporary culture, there's this attitude of, you need to be, let's say, less harsh about that kind of behavior, and you need to be more understanding of the individuals who engage in it. But unfortunately, what that has brought about is, yes, this kind of medicalization of problems that were seen as moral problems before. And when they were seen as moral problems, the culture was so overwhelmingly opposed to them that it just suppressed them completely. Well, I wouldn't say completely, but within the general awareness, there weren't these kinds of epidemics.
There were them or healed them, because I don't think we need suppression as much as we need healing.
Right.
I think people need to be empowered and instead of suppressed. And if they're being suppressed in ways that make their self-destruction more likely, then that's curious to me.
Right. And I wouldn't say that a return to the traditional responses is even practicable necessarily, because we don't live in the same world. But as an example, there have been cases in the past where entire subgroups within a society were essentially caught within the grip of a collective delusion. Actually, exactly 500 years ago, there was the so-called dancing plague of 1518 in the city of Strasbourg in France, where essentially a bunch of people started going out into the town square and dancing these very lively dances, and there would be musicians who would come out and spontaneously accompany them. And they felt a certain compulsion to do that, even to the point where they weren't eating food, they weren't sleeping, they were physically wearing themselves out to the point of collapse and death. But large segments of the population of Strasbourg felt this compulsion to just go out and dance, irrespective of what it would do to them. And this was a very strange phenomenon. It was well documented. Historians aren't sure what caused it. It could have been some sort of mold in the bread that they were eating, or some, let's say, interpretation of their spiritual teachings. Like, some of them might have thought they were possessed by demons to do it. And if people think that they're possessed, they would act out in certain ways, and they would encourage others through essentially the bandwagon effect, the perception that everybody else is doing it, so one should join in. So that's what happens when the cultural norms that restrain that behavior are eroded away, or there's a sufficiently large critical mass of people who engage in these types of activities. And I would say people have bad examples. For instance, if they see, oh, somebody committed a mass shooting and now they're famous and now their name is out there, and these individuals feel like they have been mistreated by the world and they want attention, they're not just going to quietly commit suicide, they're going to commit another mass shooting. And that's the unfortunate side effect of the age we live in, where the mass media amplify these kinds of events. And instead of trying to, in some ways, insulate people who have these tendencies from ideas that they might get to act out on them, the mass media helps perpetuate the mass shootings, so, not directly, but by spreading the notion to people. But I think the more fundamental solution is a resolution of the crisis of meaning in the contemporary world, which you alluded to, Jules. And this crisis of meaning arises out of postmodernism. Around the early 20th century, there was significant disillusionment in Western intellectual circles with the whole idea of progress. And in large part, this was a reaction to World War I, but various postmodern currents of thought had been forming even in the century leading up to that. And this rejection of the ideal of progress, this skepticism toward all forms of narrative, the desire to deconstruct everything and try to find hidden power relationships in everything, ended up ridding a large part of the general population of things to look up to, whether it be people or ideas or causes or actions that they could take. Although we know from history and we know from studying the laws of nature, some approaches work far more effectively than others. And if you use logical reasoning, if you use the scientific method, if you have a more humanistic, in a broad sense, outlook toward life, if you seek to improve the living conditions of human beings, those are powerful sources of meaning. And those are efficacious. And those give satisfaction to the individuals who engage in them. So we do have a cultural problem. We have had several generations of people who have been taught, essentially, that there are no objective sources of meaning. So either you have to be ingenious enough to create your own, and some people manage to do that fairly well, or, sorry, but you're left floundering. And some individuals, unfortunately, haven't arrived to the point where they use their own judgment, their own insights to kind of custom tailor their own life's meaning. So to have a set of broadly formulated ideals that they could readily refer to would be helpful if those ideals are constructed. Now, in some cases, attempts to formulate those ideals can be misleading and can lead people down the wrong path. Say, one of the reasons why Islamist totalitarianism has been appealing including to individuals in Western countries, individuals whose cultural heritage has some Islamic elements, but whose parents, for instance, were far more moderate. And yet some of those individuals went off to join ISIS in Iraq because ISIS offered a framework of meaning that was quite brutal and damaging and perverse, but those individuals found something to anchor their lives to. But I think the way out is actually through the ideas of transhumanism, through having this overarching framework of thought with regard to improving the human condition, to have this revival of the ideals of progress, of rationality, of technology improving the human condition, of the Enlightenment. Unfortunately, postmodernism was a strong reaction against the Enlightenment, and I think it's time for the Enlightenment to reassert itself and unite itself with the far vaster and more efficacious array of technologies that we have at our disposal. I think that's the way out for a lot of people, because if they have a positive, constructive vision of the future that they can individually work toward, then blood magic seems like a really crummy alternative.
Yeah, you call it blood magic. Magic that, to me, I thought blood magic had more to do with heritage and ancestors, and black magic had more to do with magic words and mind control and, you know, that kind of stuff. But snow magic is about chilling people, like killing their motivation, or, you know, like just slowing them down and that kind of stuff. But these terms are so esoteric and loose that I'm in a huge gray area right now. So I'm a new student of this kind of thought technology.
Well, from the perspective of helping people out, I've noticed that at least when I help people out, I feel something inside of myself, you could say it's in your heart or wherever, that elevates you to a higher level than you were before you did those things. What I wanted to also talk about, the second thing, the second concern that people may have towards transhumanism is, much like we had Socrates dismaying writing for not encouraging the ability that human beings have had before that to keep a lot of information inside of their heads and their memory. I think a similar fear may be relating to having a lot of outside things do something for you, where the actual human model ends up being denigrated over time. And this brings to mind the idea of Theseus' paradox, which is the idea that if a ship sails out somewhere, then comes back and all of its parts have been replaced, is it the same ship? A similar thing could be said about transhumanism if we're looking at the approach of, if you put a human being inside of a robotic shell, replacing everything about them, including their brain, we still have not, and please correct me if this is not the case, but we still have not found what consciousness actually is and whether or not it is possible to replace everything in the human being and keep that part of them that is them as an experiencer of life. So the point that I'm getting to here is, I think a lot of the elements in transhumanism for me personally can be incorporated into life as long as those elements would allow people to fulfill that mission of helping other people, but at the same time remaining there as the experiencer of it. And I also want to throw in one last thing, where we were talking about the artificially imposed limits that adults have that children may not necessarily have when it comes to teaching them about transhumanism. I'd say the same thing could be applied to the materialist idea, the Cartesian idea that we have today of there being consciousness only relegated inside of the human head, in the human brain, and that's it. There is no other connections that could be made. And I'm also a neophyte when it comes to all this, and I have a lot of learning to do, but I'm willing to, for the present moment, disregard any limitations whatsoever and see where that gets us, because at least we'll have that feeling inside of us when helping people.
Lev, yeah. I wanted to know what your familiarity of Giorgiani's ideas are, and if they connect to transhumanism, and you talked about the Cartesian worldview. So for some people that aren't as familiar with these spiritual or enlightenment concepts, I wanted to hear what both of you guys thought some of the connections were, or similarities or differences were to what's going on. And then I guess we'll wrap up shortly after this, but this has been an incredible conversation.
Absolutely.
And I just want to thank both of you, Giannotti.
Yes,
thank
indeed.
You so much. This has been, I hope to do this again soon.
Thank you as well.
Well, the Cartesian worldview, if I understand it correctly, is it comes from Descartes, where there is a dualism of mind and matter, which is completely separate. While the mind aspect of it has also gone the way of the dodo when it comes to many recent academics, a lot of them being atheists, who consider whatever consciousness is just something that we have not microscopically found yet when examining whatever's going on in the brainwaves. While I like the analogy that Rupert Sheldrake talked about, where when you take a toaster and you hammer it up into little tiny bits, you wouldn't necessarily be able to reconstruct that same toaster if the only thing that you know are those little bits. Those little bits don't tell you the design of the toaster, much like a little scrap of wood or even whatever's going on in our DNA. From what I understand about genetics, we still have the same DNA in our arms and our legs. They're not really determining what exactly ends up being what, whether this ends up being the arm or this ends up being a leg. There's still a lot of processes going on, which, I don't know, maybe we will discover it. But right now, I think we're still living in a very mysterious time, a time for curiosity, and not a time to necessarily say that, oh, everything else is just the work of the angels and we should just ignore it. No, not at all. But what I mean here is that the essential question still comes down to, regardless of people talking about the death of God, what exactly is this whole crazy thing about, where on a microscopic level, everything that you observe still ends up changing depending on who the observer is. So this whole thing, I think, is very crazy and very out there, just the three-dimensional reality we happen to be living in now. Sorry for being a little hippy-dippy about this, but I think that there is a lot to discover. And that the feeling that I personally get when I meditate and see all the stuff that I happen to see in that, you could also say that that's just a hallucination. But the way that it makes me experience life has been very different from the way I've experienced life before I went on that path. So at least with that own personal anecdotal experience, I think that there is way more for people, including scientists, no matter how much we have learned, to still keep on learning.
And I would say it would be fruitful to address these ideas sequentially, because I think there are three areas that can kind of transition into one another, starting with the concept of Cartesian dualism and the rejection of Cartesian dualism, then going to the Ship of Theseus issue, and then moving on to the question of how or to what extent or whether the mind could lose certain faculties as a result of interaction with exterior technologies. Now, with regard to the Cartesian dualism issue, I think a physicalist or materialist view of the world would actually reject the idea that the mind is qualitatively distinct from the physical world, in the sense that the mind is very complex, and the processes indeed that facilitate our lives and our conscious awareness are extraordinarily complex. But in large part, the scientific world today has rejected Cartesian dualism through the understanding of emergent properties. That is to say, the mind is not some sort of immaterial soul that just inhabits the body as a vessel. The mind is an integral part of the body, and the brain is an integral part of the body. And what gives rise to conscious thinking is indeed not any particular atom or molecule or structure, but the entirety of the interactions among those structures. So consciousness is a process rather than a thing. And the way in which our brain and our nervous system interact with the rest of our body is what comprises and constitutes our conscious awareness. So when I'm touching something with my finger, the nervous system relays the impulses that are actually experienced at the fingertip to my brain. But the entirety of conscious awareness happens with the involvement of all of these components throughout the body. Now, that being said, you could replace one atom of my finger with a different atom. Even hypothetically, you could replace my entire finger with a mechanical finger. And let's say you could connect it to my nervous system so that I would actually feel an impulse at the tip of that mechanical finger. I would still be me. And I would still be conscious, including of the experience of that finger. Now, if you were to replace the entirety of me with a robotic body and a robotic brain instantaneously, that would have, let's say, all of the data of my past experiences, all of my memories, and you could actually animate that robot and that android, in effect, would think that it was me and would think that it had my experiences and memories, but I'm still right here, let's say. Clearly, these are two distinct individuals, and if I were destroyed, that robot doesn't magically become me and doesn't have my conscious awareness transferred. So I would say there is a crucial difference between incremental replacement, component by component, and instantaneous destruction and reinstantiation. I have an essay on this that I wrote in 2010 called How Can I Live Forever? What Does and Does Not Preserve the Self? In which I go through various scenarios from very commonplace ones, such as sleep or general anesthesia, to more speculative ones, such as cryonics or mind uploading, or even connections hypothetically among individual brains through some sort of future network that enables that kind of connectivity, and what types of changes would preserve what I call the I-ness, one's seat of consciousness, in essence, one's vantage point upon the world. And I do think a lot of this is contingent on the particular physical changes involved. Likewise, if one were to graft an artificial neuron, a single neuron, onto one's biological brain, give that neuron time to integrate with the rest of the neurons, and then keep doing that for a while, I think it would, at least in principle, be possible to preserve a person's individuality and the same I-ness, the same vantage point upon the world. The reason that I perceive the world as myself and not as you, and I certainly wouldn't want a situation where anything that is done to my mind would result in an entity that is as distinct from my own vantage point as either of you would be, in the sense that I don't experience what you're experiencing right now. So well,
it's
important.
A difficult thing. Like, how would we know? How would we know whether or not this android in front of us is you as an experiencer being you, or is you as in everything else but the experience?
Well, right. I think we need to, I think without rejecting Cartesianism, we need to go beyond it for mm-hmm. sure. And I think that there's a lot of wisdom and insight in these mind-body, in the mind-body duality, but I think it's incomplete, and I think it's due for an update from our modern knowledge, breakthroughs in neuroscience, and I think that Cartesianism comes a lot from Plato's theory of forms. And I know Karl Popper and Giorgiani himself both thought that Plato's theory of forms was his noble lie. That he, to make his argument, he introduced a straw man's argument of Heraclitus, because he was either disturbed by the relentless change and flux of everything, but also that he thought this noble lie, the theory of forms, is what people would need to believe in to aspire for higher ideals in the face of entropy. But I think that we don't need this kind of noble lie anymore based on a theory of forms that's not tethered or based on anything other than a fancy thought experiment. I think that Cartesianism, while it might be heavily inspired and derived from Plato's theory of forms, I don't think that renders it meaningless or useless, because I actually think that this mindset and worldview gets a lot of things right, and things a lot more right than most postmodernists I've ever met. However, I do think that we want to be sensitive, not to just reject Cartesianism, but it's important to go beyond it.
Right, and I will just say briefly that there is a reason why Descartes was motivated to posit this kind of strict separation between mind and body. And one of those reasons, of course, was the extensive cultural influence of Christianity, which does something similar. But even notwithstanding that, it's a lot easier to address matters of the mind directly as mental phenomena rather than by reference to physical constituents. For instance, if you want someone to get up from a chair, you could engineer through extensive research, probably over the course of generations, the exact set of physical or electrical impulses that you would need to kind of channel into that person's organism to get that person to get up from the chair in exactly the way you want. Or you could just ask the person to get up from the chair, and which is easier. So because we have direct access to our own minds and the workings of our own minds, it is easier to formulate certain principles and generalizations that don't have to refer to the workings of the atomic world or the subatomic world or even the workings of macro scale mechanisms. Instead, we can use our own experience to derive laws of the mind. Now, biology and neuroscience would suggest that these laws of the mind are connected to the laws of the physical world, also in important ways, in ways we don't entirely understand yet, right, but hopefully right. We will. But Lev, you were going to say something before I continue.
This may be more in the direction of the hippy-dippy, so just a warning ahead of time. But I wonder if the Cartesian paradigm may actually have a lot more in terms of the mind than the body in the future, meaning that we look at ourselves as this physical body, but maybe everything that's going on is mind, pure mind, a thought, a dream, a wisp, whatever it is that you want to call it. At least in my very limited understanding of quantum physics, if whatever happens to be observed at the subatomic level depends on whoever it is that's observing it, to me, it makes me think that whatever it is that's going on is a bit of a dream, and that's the feelings that I get when I happen to go to sleep and dream and see, like, I've been writing down pretty much every single day a new dream that I've had. But I don't know, that's my naive way of looking at it. The only thing that I have to back it up, however, is in Hinduism, specifically the Shaktism or various tantric sects. They also had a dualism about them until they turned it into a monism, where you have this idea of this trinity of origination, maintaining, and destruction, or Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And then you have the physical world of Shakti, which is this energy that animates the entire universe. Before, they were considered separate, but later on they started to be seen as one thing, where from this trinity, this is the thing that gave birth to the physical manifestation, to the physical universe, while at the end of the day, it's all one thing. And it being all one thing, at least in a guttural instinct, isn't that far away from what I happen to consider this whole thing being.
Yeah, integrated information theory, it almost sounds like, the panpsychism or something. A lot of people are saying that everything has consciousness to different emerging degrees. And it's a really interesting way of thinking about things. Like, if you start thinking rocks or tables are conscious, clearly we're not saying they're having an experience comparable to what we have. But if consciousness is an emergent phenomena that depends on how integrated information is and how it's arranged in particular ways, then you can start looking at how the scale of integrated information manifests different emergent qualities of consciousness.
And it's interesting because the Transhumanist Bill of Rights, it's available on the website of the U.S. Transhumanist Party at transhumanist-party.org, discusses various levels of information integration, ranging from level zero, which refers to inanimate objects or objects that do not modify themselves in response to interaction, including rocks, to levels of information integration that are potentially more complex than today's humans are. And this is part of the preamble of the Transhumanist Bill of Rights. It is intended to delineate where sentient entities that are deserving of rights, at least rights as articulated in this document, would fall in terms of the spectrum. So I think pretty much nobody would wish to confer rights to rocks. At least I hope not. But if there is some basic type of information integration that is performed, not by a rock, but say by a simple organism, or even by a sensor, which would be level one information integration according to this categorization, then it may be interesting to kind of analyze the constituent components of that, and what is it that gives rise to an emergent property at that level. Now, that being said, our type of consciousness, which is essentially self-aware, focused, capable of selectively identifying certain aspects of the world, capable of perceiving a great level of detail and not just simple binary types of perceptions like, is there light or is there not light? That definitely involves an extremely complex and intricate interplay of physical components. And it's also limited by the laws of nature that govern those physical components. So it's at the same time more complex than each of the individual parts, but also in some ways anchored to the capabilities of those individual parts. So that if we want something that goes beyond that, we would need better hardware. So likewise, I don't think anyone's conscious mind creates this reality. I think the physical reality is more basic, more fundamental. But having organisms with this level of information integration, with this extent of complex emergent properties, enables those organisms then to create other aspects of reality by rearranging physical matter from simpler to more complex forms. And if we were to have better hardware as part of ourselves, then the extent of that creativity would improve as well. And our total ability to impact the world would certainly broaden, rendering us more efficacious and rendering us more capable of shaping the external reality in the image of our minds. So for instance, an architect wants to see a building constructed, and that architect has a vision for how that building would look, but that architect would also need to know something about structural engineering, about which materials would work with it, about what the costs of those materials would be, what labor, what other tools would be involved in creating that building. And then, harnessing all of that information, the architect could bring some vision from his mind into concrete reality. Now, what's interesting, too, is that as creative technologies advance, so technologies for the creation of art, of music, it is possible to bring something into physical reality without having as much of, let's say, this very rigorous, very specific physical training. It used to be if you wanted to hear a symphony played or any sort of musical work played, you would have to either be a musician or hire a large number of musicians and have them play it for you through physical instruments. Now you can have computer software that emulates those instruments reasonably well. And some would say not perfectly, but you could hear what that piece of music sounds like. Or you could have digital art where you don't need to have knowledge of various types of paints, for instance, or you don't need to be a master with a paintbrush. You could use digital software to achieve certain similar effects.
That's what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
I have the Cintiq in front of me, and before I used to draw on paper, now I draw with the pen right on there with the pressure sensitivity and everything, and it's great. It's very efficient, and it does allow me to get a lot of ideas that are in my head out onto the digital canvas in a really short amount of time. And I think from here, I want to thank you, Gennady. This has been such an amazing conversation, and I have learned a lot, and I still think that we have so much more that we can discuss and talk about and analyze. The only thing that I could say on behalf of myself is there is this many science books that I have to read before I think I'll be qualified to talk on certain things. But I think with the same technology that allows us to speak here, reading books has become way more easier, and I'll get to that point in no time.
Yes, and certainly this is an ever-evolving field or set of interconnected fields of knowledge. And ultimately, I do think all of reality is interconnected in crucial aspects, and individual disciplines are just facets of seeking to understand that reality. But likewise, it's been a great pleasure speaking with both of you, Lev and Jules.
Gennady, thank you so much for coming on our show. I look forward to doing it again with you, and it's been a real pleasure. Thank you again so much.
Thank you.
And if you guys enjoyed the program, please be sure to like, comment, and subscribe for more Lev and Jules goodness.
Thanks, guys. And don't forget to check out the Patreon, check us out on Twitter and Instagram, and we'll see you all soon.
Take care.